Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Hello and welcome to the China Geopolitics Podcast. I'm Finbar Birmingham, the Europe correspondent at the South China Morning Post. A big week at home and abroad for China's political movers and shakers. The National People's Congress has just come to an end. This is the biggest week in the calendar every year for Beijing. Bureaucrats fly in from all over China to say yay or nay, well, mostly just yay really, to rough plans for the year ahead. Qinling Lo, once of this parish but now toughing it out in a quarantine room in the Chinese capital ahead of starting her new gig as a Beijing reporter, along with the excellent Mai Jun, watched all of the events unfold so you didn't have to. We get some of the details on policy and even more of the palace intrigue that surrounds a massive event like this from the guys in part two. In the first half of the show, political economy editors John Carter and Joe Shin will talk about a raft of foreign engagements this week. An SCMP scoop the other day revealed that China's top two diplomats were planning to meet their US counterparts in Alaska for the first senior bilateral meeting of the Biden era. That's going ahead next week. Meanwhile, Biden himself is meeting with the Quad, a group of nations made up of the US, Japan, Australia, India. More than a few bugbears with Beijing between them. Is this a worry for China? Stay tuned, you're about to find out. It's Friday afternoon in Hong Kong. I'm joined by political economy editors at the SCMP, Joe Shin and John Carter. I'm going to talk about a few items today, the first of which is the United States and China to convene in Alaska. The first item of which is a summit between the United States and China in Alaska next week. This will be the first official meeting between senior leaders of the US and China since the Biden election, since the inauguration. We're going to have Yang Jiechi and Wang Yi from the Chinese side, Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan from the United States side, and this is going to be next Thursday. Zhou Xin, tell us a little bit about how this came about from the Chinese perspective and what is in the calculation of holding this meeting at this time.
Okay, I think after the first phone call between President Xi Jinping and Biden, and the U.S. President Biden, I think both the Chinese side and the U.S. side are seeking kind of opportunity to at least like to talk to each other, to lay the ground. So from the Chinese perspective, this is a summit, strategic talk that is going to lead to many dialogues down the road. But the U.S. side, of course, is a little bit more, as Blinken said, you know, this is not a strategic summit. You know, we decide what to do after the talking. And it also already show that there are still huge differences from between Beijing and Washington over the relationship. I mean, what's the best scenario, of course, is for China's perspective, is that after this meeting, there will be more regular contacts, you know, so the channels can be rebuilt up and there will be more talking down the way. But for the worst scenario for the Chinese government is like the one in Hawaii, remember? Last July.
Pompeo.
Yes, between Pompeo and Yang Jiechi, you know, the Yang Jiechi fly half the planet to Hawaii and sit down for 7 hours just to exchange words with their U.S. counterparts and have nothing basically agreed upon. And just each side just talking about their own talking point, and after that, they just stand up and go back home.
So on that point, Zhou Xin, do you think that the U.S. has said that they want this to be a sort of a goals or results-oriented meeting? China says they want it to be a strategic dialogue, which is essentially suggests, I suppose, that China wants more and more follow-ups. If there was to be a result from this meeting, what would that successful result be for China?
Well, I think China has made it very clear that China has no ground to give on certain issues, including South China Sea, including Xinjiang, including Hong Kong, including Taiwan. But I think China will have something to give to the U.S. side, for instance, climate change and other areas, that there will be some areas that could have some cooperation between Beijing and Washington. But nobody really knows. I mean, to what extent China will, you know, what's the final card actually China have is it remains unknown. And also, it depends what the United States can offer in return to Beijing.
Yeah.
So it's at this moment, we really don't know. We have to read very carefully about the statements from both sides to see how the dialogue actually go on.
Yeah, John. What do you think will be the hot topics from the United States? What do you think the United States will be, I suppose, in an ideal world, what would they hope to achieve? And what do you think is realistic to expect from this first meeting between the new administration and Chinese counterparts?
Well, this is a feeling out meeting between the two sides. Remember, this Biden has been in office less than 2 months. I mean, this is all new. And Biden has made it clear that they are going through a major review of their strategic plan vis-a-vis China. And so from the U.S. point of view, this is as much about gathering information about where China may be willing to be flexible and where it won't be flexible. Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, and Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, have previously written a number of articles about the need to manage the relationship with China. And so this is all about managing. The U.S. may be willing to discuss possibilities. Climate change is an obvious possibility, even potentially a cooperation on fighting coronavirus. Mm. We'll see. I mean, coronavirus remains a relatively controversial issue given the WHO's investigation in China. But nevertheless, there is potential there. On other issues, as Joshin has made clear, China has drawn lines in the sand, red lines, do not cross, this will severely damage the relationship.
So does that mean that if the United States raises the issues of Hong Kong, Xinjiang, is that something that China will not even be open to discussing, Joshin, do you think? Or is it something that there would be
if I could jump in and say
yes.
that Blinken has warned yesterday that China needs to brace itself to hear the U.S. strong views on these topics, Xinjiang and Taiwan and Hong Kong. So it will be discussed. And I don't think the U.S. position is going to be any surprise to Beijing.
No, but then again, you're going to end up in that situation with a replica of the Hawaii meeting, Joshin, if there's no room for maneuver, if Beijing has already said these are not up for discussion.
Well, as John said, I think the U.S. side would definitely raise these issues. Otherwise, there would be no point of meeting these top Chinese diplomats. On the other hand, from the China perspective, I mean, Yang Jiechi and Wang Yi will try very hard to explain why Beijing is doing this, and what will possibly be the next step from the Chinese government, and to see what kind of specific concerns the United States have, and what kind of possibly, these kind of tactical, I don't want to use this word of compromises, but actually like what kind of tactics steps that China can take, so that the United States can be less concerned about these issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you look at, Hong Kong, for instance, the electoral reform from the Western perspective view, it's killing the one country, two systems. But from the Chinese perspective, this electoral system is still very, very different from mainland China. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, it's still this is a more lean towards so-called the real election system than the MPC or the CPP system in mainland China. So from the Chinese government, what it's doing is to safeguard China's sovereignty. Of course, these kind of argument, what Beijing is trying to say is will be very difficult for the United States to accept. But at least, for Yang Jiechi and Wang Yi, they can lay out these kind of rationales, the considerations behind these moves, and to see if there could be some small understanding. At least, not to, because of the Hong Kong issue, going to a state where he's talking about massive sanctions of all MPC lawmakers, or kicking China out of the U.S. dollar system as a punishment, the Russia model of financial sanctions. These things that they can possibly talk about, like how to avoid these things. Yes, we know there's
huge differences, but at least there are some things that we agree not to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we had a strong statement overnight from both the United States and the European Union after the NPC confirmed the changes to the Hong Kong electoral system or the reform, but no concrete action, no further concrete action as yet. Watch this space. John, at the same time, the United States is embarking on a bit of a flurry of diplomatic activity in the region. Biden himself will meet with leaders from the Quad nations, which is Japan, Australia and India. Again, showing perhaps that the Biden administration is a bit more multilaterally engaged than its predecessors. What is the Quad? What do we expect from this? Why is it important? And should China have any concerns about that?
Well, the Quad has been around for years, but under Trump, it languished. And now Biden is seeking to reinvigorate it, frankly, as a way to contain China. It has been described in some circles as a potential mini NATO, but that's going too far. It's an effort to cooperate on various levels. Obviously, military issues are a major area of discussion that will come up in the meetings later today. But also there are other issues. For instance, the cooperation on vaccine production, attempts perhaps to have India ramp up its vaccine production in order to distribute it to developing countries, something that China has done very successfully in recent weeks, so-called vaccine diplomacy. So there are a lot to talk about. But given shared concerns about China, the group has grown closer. I mean, we know about the border conflict between India and China. We know about the trade disagreements between Australia and China. We know about the East China Sea Islands dispute between Japan and China. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know about the U.S.-China disagreements. And so each of the four Quad countries has reasons to cooperate vis-a-vis policy with China. Mm-hmm. And again, this is part of Biden's efforts to seek multilateral engagement in order to address issues with China.
Yeah. And so those are, as you said, John, each of those countries has a sort of litany of issues and complaints with China. To see them all come together in one forum, Joshin, is that something that maybe Beijing would not want to see, or is it a worry?
Well, I think for Beijing, certainly this is a worry. I mean, if there's an Asia version of NATO against China, this is definitely not what Beijing wants to see. But at the same time, Beijing also sees very clearly that there was a huge gaps even between the U.S. and its allies. So China has huge room to manage this. Mm. For instance, South Korea. I mean, at the same time, South Korea is a military ally of the United States, but at the same time, the economic and trade relationship with China was huge. So China can use this, to counterbalance the push. And even for Australia, I mean, we have talked a lot about why Beijing was so tough, against Australia in terms of trade, because China wants to, set the example. Mm. You can't go too far. You can't be too seen as, completely on behalf of the United States and do something to harm China's interests. And even for Japan, I think this is still, really Japan will be go so far as to enjoy kind of military alliance clearly that is targeting China. I think there are some, the jury is still out. And even India, although there's, as John mentioned, there's a huge nationalistic push at home for Modi after this border clash. But still, Modi has managed to de-escalate the situation on the border. Mm-hmm. This is a situation that I see, not all the members of the Quad are on the same page yet. Mm. So for this situation, I think Beijing also sees very clearly. Of course, what they will do in the future will also be dependent, depend on what Beijing will do. For instance, if Beijing escalate the tensions on the border with India, maybe Beijing will push India more close to the U.S. side. But if, like for the BRICS summit this year, and Xi was likely to visit India, or not, at least there's a video conference, and both sides are talking about friendship, about trade, about cooperation, and maybe the tensions will be much smaller from now. So this is what I see the situation.
And Joshin brings up a good point that on the one hand, India is in the Quad with the United States, Australia, and Japan. On the other hand, it's in BRICS with China.
Yeah.
On the one hand, Australia and Japan are at odds in certain ways with China. On the other hand, they're part of the RCEP trade agreement.
Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership.
Yes. Yes. And these days, seriously, I mean, you know, the military conflict is kind of like in no one's interest. So,
sure.
So even in competition, it's more about like economic power, about technology, rather than, you know, actually exchanging fires on the scene.
Yeah. No, I think everybody wants to have their cake and eat it with China. You know, they want to be able to trade and transact and do business with China. And at the same time, there's more pressure for each country domestically to be tough rhetorically on China. And I think we're going to see over the coming years, smaller countries are now falling into this situation where they're looking at Australia as perhaps a cautionary tale. You know, it's a very populist issue on the polling stoop. So I think, John, we might see this dilemma facing a broader suite of nations over the next few years.
Well, and China understands this, that its domestic market is so big, everyone wants to be a part of it. And so it can do what it, up to a point, what it wants to do without fear of alienating companies and individuals from other nations to the point where they don't want to be part of the Chinese market. And so this is what's driving, or one of the main drivers of Chinese policy at this point, is to reinforce its domestic means of production, because it knows that the external environment is getting more difficult. But in doing so, it's relying on its own huge domestic market, which has a huge amount of potential.
Yeah. One quick point I'd say that sort of illustrated to me this week how sort of the needle has moved was the Federation of German Industries, which is BDI, the huge business lobby in Germany, you know, which is the European nation which trades the most with China, which is heavily reliant on China, and which has been seen to be the nation to have pushed the investment treaty with China, came out with an extremely critical statement of China's MPC, the results of the MPC yesterday, saying that obviously this is a shift in the economy that they don't want to see, not towards global cooperation. And also, this was the surprising bit to me, a very political critique of the situation in Hong Kong and Xinjiang. And I thought, well, if the Federation of German Businesses is saying this, probably the most pro-China lobby in Europe, what does that say for how things really are? I thought that was a bit of a surprising one.
Well, there's rhetoric and there's action. I mean, is the BDI just paying lip service to these principles, which are widely held by the German people? I mean, the issue of genocide, it rings very true to the Germans, of course, because they the Nazi Holocaust back in the 1940s. And so it's not surprising at all that the BDI would object to certain things that, about China. But having said that, is that going to affect the way they do business with China? That's the key.
Possibly not. The surprising thing for me, I suppose, was the fact that they weren't asked for this statement. They volunteered it and sent it to me. And I thought, wow, okay. Very interesting. But just to finish up quickly before we go, John, this week we saw Chinese trade data combined for the month of January and February. Record growth, 60.6% growth compared to the January-February period last year, with the massive caveat that the economy was shut down last January-February because of COVID.
Right. The data was badly skewed because of this base effect. You're comparing against negative growth last year. So you got, this is exports, grew by 60.6%, and imports by 22.2%. Both very strong, but they were also stronger than expected, which again shows that the Chinese economy entered the new year with strong growth momentum. The trade sector is doing fine, thank you very much, despite the Lunar New Year effect, despite the new outbreak in northern China of the virus. So we'll have to see how this goes in coming months. On Monday, we get the latest data on industrial production, retail sales, and investment, and we'll see how that looks.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also as John just said, so this year was the first year of the 14th five-year plan. And in China, we don't not only have economic cycles, but also political cycles.
Yeah.
So this is a big year in terms of economic growth, because lots of new projects are going to break the ground and lots of new projects are going to start this year. So although the central Chinese government say 6%, I mean, most reasonable economists will say the minimum growth should be like 8% or even higher.
Yeah.
So this year will be very, very interesting to see. I mean, how fast China can grow. And given a constraint to the low base in 2020, if there's no surprises in terms of economic growth, China is going to have a very good year.
Yes.
Well, we look forward to following it closely. John, Zhuxin, thank you so much.
As critical news stories emerging from China continue to shape lives and business around the world, the weekly SCMP Global Impact Newsletter brings you expert analyses and insights on the economics of COVID-19, society, technology, and the environment. Sign up to receive your weekly email at scmp.com/newsletters.
The end of a big week in Beijing. The National People's Congress came to a close yesterday with a long press conference by Premier Li Keqiang. And I am delighted to be joined by two colleagues who followed this not just for the week, but for the week before that. They've really been immersed in all things NPC for the past fortnight. Mai Jun and Kinling Lo are reporters based in Beijing for The Post. Mai Jun, first of all, one of the things that we led with here was the reform of Hong Kong's electoral system. And I know you were watching this very closely. Could you maybe set the scene for us? Like, how did this come about? How does this sort of thing pass into, you know, the legislative system in at the NPC? And what was the general vibe up there in Beijing?
Thank you, Finbar. First of all, I think to begin with, I need to say that people here, most people in mainland and definitely in Beijing, had no clue about the upcoming electoral reform that would be passed in the NPC until the very night before the opening of the NPC. So what they did is they added one item to the agenda of the NPC, and that was the first time that everybody knows is a certain that this issue will be discussed at the NPC. People in Hong Kong and the press in Hong Kong have been talking about it for weeks, but that was because, you know, maybe delegates in Hong Kong are more open to talking to the press, and they're more transparent about what they know. But people in the mainland, most of them were clueless that such an important bill was going to drop on the NPC. And that was also exactly what happened last year when they decided to pass a resolution to give power to the NPC's standing committee to draft a law, the Hong Kong National Security Law.
Can I just ask you on that point, Mai Jun? So for the average person in China who maybe didn't know that it was going to be on the agenda, is this a big deal? Is it really important for them to know about the electoral reform in Hong Kong? Do they care?
I think, I think a lot of people in China began to care more about Hong Kong since the protest in 2019, because information was strictly controlled. What they see, everything they know about the protest, or there were some protesters getting violent, and some of them are storming the LegCo, and some of them are storming the liaison office, which is the symbol of Beijing's power. So the discussion about Hong Kong on mainland, the public discussion are actually very, very limited to this good versus evil, Beijing versus these pro-independence Hong Kongers. Mm-hmm. But I would say that people cared about it much more last year when they first understand that there was a national security law coming up. But I do not see that many people talking about it this year, about the electoral reform.
Yeah. So at this stage, it was added to the agenda. Give us a just really quick 30-second thumbnail sketch of what was in the reform package. And how did it then come to pass? I understand they were voting on this. A bit of color around that would be great, Mai Jun.
So basically, the resolution is expanding the electoral committee and also expanding the seats of the LegCo so that it makes Beijing easier to staff its loyalists. There's also a vetting community that systematically check whether anyone trying to register as a candidate can be considered as patriots. But I also need to be clear about one thing. That is, the NPC delegates, they were voting on a resolution that has maybe just some very basic details about the electoral form. They are not voting on a very specific electoral reform plan. So I believe there is a more specific electoral reform plan that will be passed and enacted by the NPC Standing Committee after the resolution was passed last week. This is also similar to what happened last year, but it was worse last year because the NPC delegates were clueless about what was going to be in the national security law of Hong Kong. But all they did was they voted on a resolution that would give power to the NPCSC to draft such a law. So when I talked to some delegates about what they think about it, they were like, oh, it's definitely going to be a good deal. Then I asked them the details about the law. They were like, oh, I don't know. I haven't seen them myself.
Yeah, so this was a similar sort of situation, and then it went to be voted on. And how did that go?
The delegates would see a copy of the of the resolution, and then they voted on that resolution. So that resolution was passed yesterday with only one abstention vote. Not sure whether that surprises, but whether that came, I don't know whether that came as a surprise to anyone. But I think it's always technically pretty difficult for even for the National People's Congress to ensure an all yes vote. I mean, even last year when there was this when they voted on the resolution on the Hong Kong National Security Law, more people abstained from that bill, and if we look back further back at a constitution amendment in 2018, which was politically extremely important and basically empower Xi Jinping to rule as long as he wishes to, that bill was not passed on all yeses basis. There were a few abstentions and a few objections.
Yeah, and so these, we never really get to see who it is that's abstaining, right? So these are just sort of anonymously voted on an electronic system, is that right?
Well, exactly. Of course, I mean, everybody would try to guess who the guy is, but let's be perfectly clear that the voting record is not public in China, and it's extremely difficult to try to pin down who the guy is that voted abstention. There is a red button and a green button and then a white button. So there are three buttons on the seat of every delegate. So green means yes, red means no, and white means abstain. So there is there's some interesting discussion a few years ago when a delegate proposed switching the color of between red and green, because the delegates' argument is a lot of the lawmakers seated on the MPC are from rural places and they have a limited level of education. And then for them to actually get familiar with the concept similar to the traffic light, which is green means go, red means stop, it's actually pretty difficult. It's actually easier for those people if we change it into the system in which red means yes, and green means no, because red in traditional Chinese culture means something good. So that means pass, go ahead, celebration.
Yeah.
Green means something else.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating to hear the intricacies of debates like that. Kinling, I'm going to bring you in at this point because you very diligently were live tweeting Li Keqiang's press conference at the end of the NPC. We were all on the edge of our seats, as I'd imagine you also were. Give us a few highlights from that.
Right, so Chinese Premier Li Keqiang, he holds a press conference at the end of the two sessions every year, where he rounds up key issues that caught both domestic and international attention. Usually he addresses matters relating to China's economy, society, and foreign relations. And that's what he did as well for his press conference, which was held virtually yesterday. The highlight of these press conferences, usually it's on economy, because Premier Li is mainly the man who delivered the work report at the start of the sessions, where economy is usually a big highlight for foreign attention. In the press conference, he spent quite a lot of time defending China's economic outlooks and economic targets, because last year, during the pandemic, China didn't set a GDP growth target, which was unusual. But this year, they have set quite a fake target to be over 6%. And some, I guess, regional watchers think it's like a slowing down. It's a proof of slowing down of Chinese economy. But he spent, I think, at least 10 minutes defending how China's economy needs to grow like sustainably and at a steady pace. So Premier Li actually used quite a brilliant tone to say that 6% is really not that low. So that was obviously the main focus of the presser. And there were also parts on where he defended, like Marjun just said, like the Hong Kong part, like electoral change, and like Hong Kong and Taiwan, like he made some repetitive comments, but that China would really like to stress, even if it was repetitive, because I mean, especially on Hong Kong, Beijing government has been facing a lot of international pressure on their tightened grip of rule. So that would be one of the things that they really want to address to the press. But I thought there was another highlight, which was interesting, was that he took the second question in the press conference. And just to add a note that the sequencing of questions and the media that he chose to answer from is watching point, because these kind of press conferences from held by the Chinese government is highly designed and well-staged. They would carefully handpick the certain journalists from certain media to ask a very specific question that they already know beforehand, before they take it at the press conference. So we can analyze from the sequence of the questions and the topics on what kind of message China is trying to show. So for the second question that Li Keqiang took, it was from foreign media, and it was on whether or not China is willing to give the World Health Organization investigation team that is looking into origins of coronavirus, whether China is willing to provide data of patient cases that carry some coronavirus symptoms back in October to December in 2019. That is because that there's this whole controversy about the origins of coronavirus, and the WHO team, which was in Wuhan in February after they left China, that was this accusation that came out from some experts that said China was not able to provide all the information experts needed. So I thought Li Keqiang really took the chance of the press conference to try to dismiss some of these allegations and worries from the international environment.
Yeah, he's almost on the aggressive throughout this, you know, defending China's economic performance, defending China's coronavirus cooperation with the WHO. Would you say, Kinling Maijun, this is almost like an unusually defensive position for the premier to take at such an event like this?
No, actually, I think it was quite the purpose of these kind of press conference. It was for him to send a very clear message to international audiences, addressing them of issues that China knows they're about responding to accusations, I would say. So that was like, I guess for China, an important platform for them to dismiss some allegations and put that Beijing narrative back on the stage.
But just to finish up here, guys, I mean, it's obviously a huge event in the Chinese political calendar. Many journalists are following this, and we're in the era of the pandemic, of course, so it's not like business as usual. Maijun, how is it as a reporter to follow the NPC? A lot of screen time or on the phone a lot. Tell us how you generally go about it.
The short answer is it's much more difficult and much less fun. I think the fun part in the past was just actually going to the Great Hall of the People, doorstepping the delegates, doorstepping the officials, and ask them tough questions in the face. And I think it was also quite a lot of fun to sit at the press a seating area and watch how Xi Jinping interact with other senior leaders, because that's not something that we could see on television. But this year, of course, they limited the size of the reporters at the scene. So I only went to the opening ceremony of the CPPCC and was able to only watch the rest of the sessions from TV. Of course, I tried to submit a lot of interview requests through the system, but many of them got rejected. And on the average, I got 10 rejections per request, which is something I find really funny.
Yeah, yeah. Sign of the times. Kinling, how has it been for you?
So I have been covering the whole two sessions this year in my quarantine room because I actually really miss recording the podcast in the SCMP's Hong Kong office. But now I'm here in my hotel room, and actually, it made me kind of forgot that I am in quarantine because there was so much to do. So I guess it's helpful for me then.
All right, guys, that's great. Thanks so much for taking the time. We'll get you back on soon. Stay safe and take care. That's it for this week's edition of the China Geopolitics Podcast. Don't forget, you'll be seeing the latest news and analysis from the Alaska meeting next week on scmp.com. You can also follow the SCMP Political Economy team on Twitter at SCMP Economy. I am posting all sorts of updates from my new beat across Europe and China. I'm at F Birmingham. Interesting times continue. No matter where you are, we'll be here for you next week.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.